Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to start with the Royals, move into the Hollywood section, and then, of course, into politics. Our first headline in the Royal section, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle excluded from royal family's Christmas plans. For the sixth year in a row, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex will skip the royal family's holiday traditions. This is by Eve Beatty on November 30th. Those who hoped that the British royal family's difficult year might end with a happy reunion should prepare for disappointment. According to a new report, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have not been invited to the Windsor family's Christmas celebration again this year, following their exclusion this summer from Trooping the Colour, the annual pageant in celebration of the ruling monarch's birthday. According to an anonymous source who spoke with People, Harry and Meghan were intentionally left off the guest list at the royal family's Christmas gathering at the Sandringham Estate in Norfolk, a get-together that's been a tradition for over a century. Harry's brother, Prince William, his wife, Kate Middleton, and children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis, are still expected to join King Charles III at the holiday celebration, as they have nearly every year they've been on the planet. Prince Harry's last appearance at the royal family's holiday celebration was in 2018, just a few months after Markle and he wed. Less than 6 months later, Prince Archie, the couple's first child, was born. By January 2020, Harry and Meghan announced that they were stepping down from their royal duties and moving to the U.S., a decision punctuated the following year with a bombshell interview with Oprah Winfrey, during which the couple detailed allegedly toxic treatment while living in the midst of the royal family. Since their move to California, the couple have seen little of the royal family, with the 2022 funeral of Queen Elizabeth and a brief visit between Harry and his father Charles following the latter's cancer diagnosis this February. The meeting stoked hopes in some corners that the crisis would mend the separation within the family, or that Middleton's announcement of her own cancer struggle the following month might bring the factions together. Those wishes were dashed in June when it became clear that Meghan and Harry would not attend Trooping the Colour, though that disappointment was tempered by Middleton's appearance at the event amid her chemotherapy journey. According to a source who spoke with People magazine, at this point, Harry's calls to his father go unanswered. He has tried to reach out about the King's health, but those calls go unanswered too. Neither the Duke and Duchess of Sussex nor the royal family have officially commented on the ongoing rift, which, while higher profile and grander than most, is likely relatable to the slews of people who have parted ways with their families in recent years, a mental health forward trend known as family estrangement. But even before Meghan and Harry made their break with the family, Harry's mother, Princess Diana, spoke openly about how much she disliked spending Christmas at Sandringham. "It was highly fraught," Diana told biographer Andrew Morton of the tradition, describing the holiday at the estate as terrifying and so disappointing. No boisterous behavior, lots of tension, silly behavior, silly jokes that outsiders would find odd but insiders understood. I sure was an outsider. A bit of royal news combined with celebrity news. Meghan Markle comforted a teary Tyler Perry as Oprah Winfrey gave a speech about him. This is by Paul Chi on December 5th. Meghan Markle made a special appearance at the Paley Honors Fall Gala on Wednesday to pay tribute to her friend Tyler Perry, who was recognized for his prolific filmmaking career and philanthropic achievements. The Duchess of Sussex attended the celebration in Beverly Hills without Prince Harry, who was in New York for the New York Times Deal Book Summit, but spent the evening in the company of Perry, Oprah Winfrey, and Kerry Washington. Wearing a chic strapless black gown by Oscar de la Renta and a diamond necklace, Meghan arrived at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel's sprawling ballroom and sauntered down the red carpet until she noticed the billionaire media mogul at the end of the step and repeat. In a giddy manner, she scurried over, clapping her hands before greeting Perry with a long hug. The two shared a conversation and happily posed for a photograph together. During the gala's cocktail hour, Meghan chatted with John Feltheimer, the CEO of Lionsgate Entertainment, and Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos and his wife Nicole Avant, a producer and the former U.S. ambassador to the Bahamas. Meghan previously worked with Sarandos, who greenlit Harry and Meghan, her 2022 Netflix documentary series. Although Meghan did not appear on stage during the gala to publicly praise Perry, she sat next to him and supported him throughout the entire night, especially when Winfrey delivered a powerful speech about his ginormous spirit in fulfilling dreams for strangers and overcoming severe physical abuse by his father and sexual abuse by several adults in his community. He took his pain and his trauma and transformed that into art, into humor, and into hope, Winfrey told the audience. He made people feel seen and feel they matter, and that is the secret and the power of Tyler Perry's success. Rapturous applause followed Winfrey's 14-minute remarks, and Meghan comforted Perry as he held back tears. When accepting his honor, Perry explained why he was extremely emotional, noting that his mother had almost died 15 years ago to the day. During this time of year, he said, he finds it really difficult to be social and typically doesn't book anything. I hide out, I go into the mountains, I pray, I talk to God, and I just be alone so that I can grieve, he said, because I don't know how grief is going to show up. Meghan's close friendship with Perry began when he offered his Los Angeles home as a refuge where Meghan and Harry could stay with their son Archie while transitioning out of their royal roles in 2020. He also provided them with security when the British government removed Harry's full-time, state-funded police protection. Winfrey told the audience about Perry's empathy and penchant for helping people like Meghan and Harry in times of need. Let me tell you, he's a giver. A real giver, Winfrey said. He is the quiet good Samaritan. He is the fixer. He is the healer. Most of his charity no one ever sees or hears about. The majority of people watch the news and they think, oh, what a shame. Tyler watches and says, what can I do to make a change? The Paley Gala is one of many events that Meghan has attended in support of the multi-hyphenate entertainer. She and Harry previously joined him at his 55th birthday bash in September. Perry is the godfather of their daughter, Lilibet, and he attended her christening last year at their home in Montecito, California. He thanked Meghan and all the gala attendees, who included Tina Knowles and Debbie Allen, for their support. I don't know how much time I have left on this planet, but what I do know is that I want to love as much as I can. I want to spread as much joy and good as I can, Perry said. I want to make my mother proud, and I want to make my son proud of his father, something that I was never able to be of the man who raised me. So I want to thank the Paley Center for this moment, this opportunity, this award, and I want to thank everybody here that showed up for me as a man. Other celebrity news, Ariana Grande has had it with beauty and body shaming. No one has a right to say shit. This is by Casey Wickman on December 6th. Ariana Grande has had enough of strangers talking about her appearance, and for that matter, everyone else's too. In a joint interview with Grande and Wicked co-star Cynthia Erivo published Thursday, a French content creator who goes by the online handle Crazy Sally asked Grande how a good witch deals with trolls. Grande seemed taken by surprise by the question and choked up with emotion briefly before answering. I've been doing this in front of the public and been a specimen in a petri dish, really, since I was 16 or 17, she said, of hearing criticism about herself through the years. I have heard it all. I've heard every version of it, of what's wrong with me, and then you fix it, and then it's wrong for different reasons. It's hard to protect yourself from that noise, she said. And then Glinda shared some words to live by for all of us. It's something that is uncomfortable no matter what scale you're experiencing it on. Even if you go to Thanksgiving dinner and someone's granny says, oh my God, you look skinnier, what happened? Or you look heavier, what happened? This is something that is uncomfortable and horrible no matter where it is happening, no matter the scale it's happening on. And I think in today's society, there's a comfortability that we shouldn't have at all commenting on others' looks and appearance, what they think is going on behind the scenes, or their health, or how they present themselves. From what you're wearing, to your body, to your fave, to everything, there's a comfortability that people have commenting on that. That I think is really dangerous, and it's dangerous for all parties involved. This isn't the first time Grande has spoken out about struggling with beauty standards and public opinion. In a 2023 video for Vogue showing off her makeup routine, she got emotional while talking about her past use of fillers and Botox, which she said she stopped using in 2018. I just felt like hiding, you know? Her relationship with the idea of beauty has changed over the years, she told Vogue, especially since I started so young. Over the years, I used makeup as a disguise or as something to hide behind. More and more and more hair, and more and more and more thicker the eyeliner, the whatever, she said. I still have love for it and appreciation for it, but I think as I get older, I don't love that being the intention behind it anymore. As Grande concluded her answer in the Crazy Sally interview, she drew a breath and ended on a cathartic joke. Can you tell I needed that today? Other Hollywood news, Shailene Woodley picked herself up after Aaron Rodgers' breakup by embracing the great outdoors. This is by Casey Wickman on December 4th. Shailene Woodley recognized, then healed, her heartache through nature. I knew I was depressed when I looked at a tree and felt nothing, she said in an interview with Outside magazine published Tuesday, in honor of the publication selecting her as their Outsider of the Year. That was the lowest low of my life. I feel like I lost my soul, myself, my happiness, my joy, she said, seemingly referring to the aftermath of her 2022 breakup with fiancé Aaron Rodgers. I really understood depression and anxiety and, like, complete soul detachment. She also lost some of her camping equipment in the split. I had to stop at REI and get a new sleeping pad, she said during the interview, which revolved around a night of camping and a photo shoot. I left my old one with my ex. The person who styled Outside's shoot, Woodley's friend, Chris Zero, is also the person Woodley credits with pulling her out of the dumps, even when that meant doing decidedly unglamorous grunt work. Sometimes I was so angry at her, Woodley said of Zero, who she said woke her up by blasting music pretty much every day for 6 months after the split. But then we'd go surf, and for 10 minutes that day I thought life could be okay again. And then the depression would come back and she'd go, we're volunteering at the horse ranch. And we'd find a random fucking horse ranch and we'd clean up horse shit. We'd clean hooves and brush the horses. And for 20 minutes that day, I thought life could be okay again. And then the depression came back and she'd wake me up the next morning and go, let's go on a hike and bring trash bags and clean up trash. Of course, it takes more than just one woman and manual labor to lift a depression. Woodley also had her work, including Three Women, a Showtime-turned-stars series she co-starred in alongside Betty Gilpin, DeWanda Wise, and Gabrielle Creevy, which aired earlier this year. In January 2023, Woodley told Net-A-Porter that she released some of her feelings around her heartbreak on set. Three Women feels like it matters a lot. Mostly, I think, because it mattered so much to me, she said. I feel honored to be part of it because it genuinely gave me a North Star in a time in my life when my compass, calibration, did not exist. It was hard to film because I was going through the darkest, hardest time in my life. It was winter in New York, and my personal life was shit, so I felt like a big pain bubble for 8 months, she said. I was so grateful that at least I could go to work and cry and process my emotions through my character. At the time of the split, a source close to Rodgers called it an amicable one, saying, they will remain friendly, there's no bad blood and no drama, it just didn't work out for them. Now, however, the party line seems to have shifted to say the least. As Woodley told Outside, she was in a toxic situation. She named Rodgers only once in the interview. I haven't shared much about my relationship with Aaron because it always makes me cry, she said. It was not right, but it was beautiful. In August 2022, Rodgers, currently making headlines for admitting that he was sad that people were mad that he refused to be vaccinated for COVID, and who was reportedly a potential VP pick for RFK Jr.'s failed presidential campaign, appeared on the Aubrey Marcus podcast and credited ayahuasca with helping him through the rough patch. To me, one of the core tenets of your mental health is that self-love, he said. That's what ayahuasca did for me. Was help me see how to unconditionally love myself. Representatives for Woodley declined to comment for this story. Our next Headline is a fun story. Hallmark's Chief-inspired movie comes home for the holidays. Once this airs in Kansas City, it's going to be like the moon landing. This is by Savannah Walsh on December 2nd. As her son plays football on the field below, some fans angle their faces toward Donna Kelsey, who sits high above in a box on loan to Hallmark. She brings both a serene smile and armed security to the packed suite where she comes to chat about Holiday Touchdown, a Chiefs love story, which the network propelled into production after tight end Travis Kelsey and global superstar Taylor Swift began their real-life love story. The matriarch, now known as Mama Kelsey, entered Arrowhead Stadium for a post-Thanksgiving game between the Kansas City Chiefs and Las Vegas Raiders to a flurry of flash bulbs. Still, she doesn't think locals are just as eager for a glimpse of her as they are to see Taylor and Travis. "They just know who I am," Kelsey tells Vanity Fair with that same insistent grin. "They expect me to be here because I'm Travis's mom. Many of these people have had seats in the stadium for generations. Football's family in Kansas City." It sounds like a line straight out of Holiday Touchdown, an advantageous marriage of two storied Kansas City brands. The Chiefs are back-to-back Super Bowl champions who have lost only one game since last Christmas. Hallmark's greeting card business has been headquartered in Kansas City since its founding in 1910, and yet somehow a Hallmark holiday film had never been filmed in the area. It took a fake trailer for a made-up movie called Falling for Football to ignite that spark of brand synergy. As Hallmark exec Samantha DePippo tells Vanity Fair, both brands officially came to an epiphany around the same time the Chiefs won their last Super Bowl. This past NFL season was basically like a Hallmark movie. Before long, Julie Sherman Wolfe, writer of more than 20 Hallmark films over nearly a decade, was summoned. "It was only a week after the Super Bowl that they asked me to write this movie. The ironic twist of this whole thing is that I'm actually a very diehard 49ers fan," says Wolfe. "I was definitely still licking my wounds, but I'm a professional. Delving into enemy territory proved less painful than Wolfe imagined. I have to admit, I don't hate the team," she says sheepishly. "I just want to beat them in the Super Bowl, that's all." Even though Kelsey and Swift's relationship helped catalyze the film, it's less obviously ripped from the headlines than Lifetime's recent, far more blatantly Tavis-inspired movie, Christmas in the Spotlight. "I think they'll stand the test of time," Wolfe says of Swift and Kelsey's courtship, "but you don't want the success of your movie to be based on somebody else's relationship." Instead, the film pays homage to the romance that they brought to the Chiefs and NFL via Derek. Taylor Hines, a Hallmark vet who also appeared in Falling for Football, head of fan engagement for the Kansas City football team, and Hunter King's Alana, a local diehard fan. They fall for each other as he judges whether her family is fit to win the Chiefs Fan of the Year award. A real thing, promises this Kansas City native. The couple meets cute at the barbecue restaurant Norma and Nick's, not a real thing, managed by a woman named Donna, who also happens to be played by Donna Kelsey. She has a similar role in Hallmark's 2024 Philadelphia-centered holiday film Christmas on Call. Mama Kelsey wears a number 87 Chiefs jersey in honor of her son, but confirms to Vanity Fair that she is not playing herself in the film, inviting an all-important question. Does Travis Kelsey exist in this Hallmark Chiefs multiverse? "I guess he exists in the universe," says the film's screenwriter. There are cameos from current players, including Mecole Hardman and Trey Smith, as well as head coach Andy Reid, but Travis's name is not specifically mentioned in this movie. Travis Kelsey and his brother Jason publicly acknowledged Holiday Touchdown during a recent episode of their New Heights podcast. Meanwhile, Laura Krug, the Chiefs' first-ever chief marketing officer, previously told Vanity Fair that the team is eager to maintain Swift's privacy during the rollout. "We consider her part of the Chiefs' kingdom," Krug said. "We respect her as a fan. We respect them as a couple in their personal lives." And even Donna Kelsey is being demure about her performance. "I don't even know if I want to watch myself, because you're always your own worst critic," she says. Yet she is unwavering in her love for Casey. "I know this city so well over the past 11 years, and I was just so excited to bring a light onto Kansas City. This is a wonderful town. They treat me and my family with so much love, and my son and I give it right back." 2 weeks and approximately 1,200 miles away from Kansas City, the cast of Holiday Touchdown gathers at Rolf's, a German restaurant near the New York City's Gramercy Park that's famous for its year-round holiday decorations. Minutes after he enters the establishment, a couple at a nearby table recognizes Tyler Hines, who starred in nearly 20 Hallmark movies since 2018, and asks to buy him a drink. "That's the tastiest thing I've ever had in my life," Hines said after sipping his beverage and before making a shocking confession for someone synonymous with Christmas, "I've never had eggnog." Our server says we've snagged a table during the restaurant's mid-November sweet spot. Arrive 1 week earlier and it might be empty. Come 1 week later and it's a tinsel-strewn zoo. Timing was similarly key for Holiday Touchdown, which wasn't announced until a week before filming began. Cast members signed NDAs before joining the project, and the film's leading couple didn't meet until the table read. "Nothing will bond you like a Southwest flight," King says of the cast's first foray into typical Midwest air travel. Watching Tyler try to figure out what it meant to line up and go to your seat. Since then, Hines has become a dedicated Chiefs fan. He's even gone back to binge-watch past seasons, referring to individual games as episodes and playoffs or Super Bowls as a season finale. While other football franchises can feel a little bit more clinical and polished, says the actor, Chiefs players are working class, all heart, and they keep winning on these bizarre turns of events. If I would have opened up the hood on this team and it was different, I would probably just go back to my life. But before bed for the last 2 or 3 months, it's Chiefs every night before I pass out. Once Kansas City caught wind of the movie, its citizens showed up in droves to tailgate outside scenes filmed in Independence, Missouri. On Mondays, local crew members quizzed the cast on which barbecue joints they had frequented over the weekend. Ed Begley Jr., a vegan, praised the barbecue tofu at Jack Stack Barbecue. And when it came time to film scenes at the Chiefs Arrowhead Stadium during three of the hottest days in July, thousands of extras braved the scalding heat in sweaters and scarves. DePippo says production chugged more than 1,200 bottles of water in a single day. "We were on stroke watch," said Megan Price, who plays Alana's mother, Leah. "But there was nary a complaint from the crowd," adds Hines. "It was fascinating to see how willing and patient everyone was in such crazy circumstances." Much of the movie hinges on a family's lucky hat, which they believe must be worn on Christmas Day for the Chiefs to make it to the Super Bowl. The script called for a Chiefs baseball cap until Chris Stathos, head of partnerships at Hallmark Brand Experiences, remembered his grandfather wearing a Chiefs beanie to shovel snow during the holiday season. "When he passed away, my dad got that hat, and one day I know it'll be mine," he texted DePippo. "Everybody put on a little bit of themselves into the movie in some way," she says. Diedrich Bader, who plays Alana's father in the film, returned to the area for the first time since doing press for 1993's The Beverly Hillbillies. "Kansas City people are really into Kansas City," he tells me, a fact with which I am all too familiar. Have I mentioned that I grew up there too? "There's a lot of city pride. It's the only location I've been to where 100% of the people guessed why I was there. The film," he predicts, "is going to be major. I think once this airs in Kansas City, it's going to be like the moon landing." There is indeed plenty of fervor, if not full-on hysteria, when Holiday Touchdown launches on a chilly Saturday night in Kansas City. A crowd of fans flock to watch the film's red carpet premiere at the very same downtown Sheraton Hotel that hosted my senior high school prom. "Are you in the movie?" an employee asks upon my arrival, a testament to just how many locals populate the film, including City Mayor Quentin Lucas, a pet named Patrick Mahomes, who went viral for his wigged resemblance to Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes, and, as I'll discover later, my fourth grade teacher. At a premiere, Hallmark hunks like Jonathan Bennett and Wes Brown mingled with Kansas City-based Bachelor Nation stars Tanner and Jade Roper Tolbert, as well as both Chiefs and Hallmark alumni. Reactions to the film's concept range from apathetic, "You've seen one, you've seen them all." One of the event's bartenders shrugs when asked if he'd ever seen a Hallmark movie, too ecstatic. "My friends will say I'm a walking Hallmark card," says one retired employee of the company who's wearing a gold evening gown and red jacket with a bedazzled football on it for the occasion. Later at the premiere, a woman named Chris, who spent her career working for Kansas City's baseball and football teams, brags about the grandson who shares her name. Like many in the city, he has worked for both the Chiefs and Hallmark, helping to secure his Yaya a spot as one of the extras of those scorching days in Arrowhead Stadium. "Soon," said grandson, approaches our table, a worn red beanie in hand. It doesn't take long to realize that this is the hat, a slightly frayed, fuzzied in a good way keepsake that looms large in Holiday Touchdown. The hat reminds me of what inspired screenwriter Julie Sherman Wolfe to write the heirloom into the movie, a satin 49ers jacket passed down from her late father, which she bequeathed to her 15-year-old son. Connor was convinced that he had to wear it in a particular way for the 49ers to win, she said. The poor kid still blames himself for losing the Super Bowl because the top button wasn't buttoned. After cheering on two sons in the NFL, Mama Kelsey isn't superstitious, but the people in her viewing box for Friday's game, Taylor Swift and her father Scott among them, are prone to some game day pressure. "My friends in the suite said, if they start winning, then don't come back," she tells Vanity Fair from Hallmark's spot in the stadium, "so I have to stay here." As if scripted by Hallmark, and some would grumble, NFL refs, the Chiefs won in dramatic fashion during the final seconds of their games against the Raiders. But a true storybook ending wouldn't be complete without a little snow. The next morning, hours before Holiday Touchdown's premiere, Kansas City got its first frost of the season. Call it coincidence if you must, but those under the Hallmark and Chiefs hometown spell would prefer to keep drinking the cocoa. Before we move into the politics section, this is a story that has been in the headlines this week. United Healthcare CEO's killing exposes a widespread fury at a broken system. This is by John Skolink and Caitlin Dewey on December 6th. Brian Thompson, the 50-year-old CEO of United Healthcare, was gunned down on Wednesday morning in what police have described as a premeditated, pre-planned, targeted attack. The crime has evoked widespread shock and condemnation, but it is also exposed, in an occasionally sadistic fashion, the profound depths of Americans' rage toward their broken healthcare system. "The jokes about the United CEO aren't really about him," journalist Ken Klippenstein wrote on his Substack. "They're about the rapacious healthcare system he personified and which Americans feel deep pain and humiliation about." Prior to his killing, Thompson, who was reportedly under investigation by the Justice Department for possible insider trading, had apparently been receiving threats. "I just know that he said there were some people that had been threatening him," his wife told NBC News. "Basically, I don't know, a lack of coverage. I don't know details." The act has been widely condemned by public officials, from Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar to Republican Senator Rick Scott. But in the 48 hours since Thompson's killing, social media has lit up with mockery and disdain for both Thompson and the wider industry he represented. When United Health Group posted the news of Thompson's death to Facebook on Wednesday, the vast majority of reactions, more than 76,000 and counting, were the laugh-crying emoji. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about the killing of the CEO of United Healthcare. Quote, "Saw mainstream news coverage about the killing of the CEO of United Healthcare on TikTok, and I think political and industry leaders might want to read the comments and think hard about them," the political strategist Tobita Chow wrote on X, sharing several screenshots of the reaction on TikTok. They included a slew of jokes about health insurance jargon like prior authorization, complaints about substandard coverage, and the observation that many thousands of people had reacted with similar schadenfreude. However insensitive, these reactions cut to an anger shared by many Americans at the state of the health insurance industry. United Healthcare, the single largest health insurer by market share, has been embroiled in a series of high-profile non-payment and coverage denial scandals. No one knows precisely how often private insurers deny claims, but a September 2023 survey by the health policy group KFF found that nearly 1 in 5 insured adults had a claim turned down by insurers in the U.S. over the 12 months prior. UnitedHealthcare, in particular, has reportedly used computer algorithms to automatically deny rehab care to vulnerable seniors in Medicare Advantage plans, a practice the company is being sued over in a class action complaint. Earlier this year, a Senate committee also found that UnitedHealthcare, as well as Humana and CVS, the owner of Aetna, limited access to post-acute care for Medicare Advantage patients at far higher rates than they did for other types of care. A spokesperson for United Health Group said the class action suit had no merit and claimed that the denials were simply based on coverage criteria and the terms of the insurance plans. As for the Senate report, a company spokesperson likewise claimed that it mischaracterizes the Medicare Advantage program and our clinical practices while ignoring critical criteria demanding greater scrutiny around post-acute care. Meanwhile, the company's revenue ballooned to the tune of $372 billion last year. Thompson himself took home $10.2 million in compensation last year, an eye-popping figure that has predictably made the rounds on social media. Perhaps unsurprisingly, public polling shows that Americans dislike the insurance industry overall. In a 2023 Gallup poll, a mere 5% of respondents described insurers' services as excellent, and 20% said that cost caused them to put off treatment of a serious medical condition. Which may explain why some Americans are quite literally celebrating murder. On Wikipedia, editors locked down pages about Thompson and his death after users altered them to describe the executive as a parasite and a con man who is currently burning in hell. It's actually kind of touching that the one thing that can bring together our fractious and disunited country is celebrating the assassination of a health insurance CEO, posted David Austin Walsh, a University of Virginia historian. Anyway, try to live your life in such a way that if you're murdered, the entire internet doesn't think that you had it coming. The New York Police Department has released surveillance images of the suspected shooter from a Starbucks and a youth hostel and offered a $10,000 reward for more information. The photo of footage from the hostel shows the possible suspect smiling at a female staffer, according to police, with his face partly obscured by his hood. With the shooter still at large, many social media users have attempted to sleuth out his identity and identify possible motives. Police told reporters that the masked gunman used bullets emblazoned with the words deny, defend, and depose, a version of a slogan commonly used to describe insurers' tactics for delaying coverage. Relatedly, Delay, Deny, Defend is the name of a 2010 book by the Rutgers University law professor Jay Feinman, which excoriated the insurance industry's claim payment practices. The resemblance has not gone unnoticed by social media users who appear to have brought the premise of the book, which is now out of print, to the center of public discourse. To improve their profits, insurance companies delay payments of justified claims, deny payments altogether, and defend their actions by forcing claimants to enter litigation, Feinman wrote in promotional materials. It's unconscionable, and it's widespread. We are moving into the politics section. Our first headline, Trump gets the red carpet treatment in Paris ahead of Notre Dame Cathedral's reopening. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on December 7th. President-elect Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron shared a handshake outside of Élysée Palace and on the red carpet on Saturday ahead of the nation's celebration of the reopening of Notre Dame Cathedral. It's the pair's first in-person meeting since Trump won last month and the latest episode in the two world leaders' tumultuous on-again-off-again diplomatic relationship. World leaders are flocking to Paris to honor repairs at the cathedral, which suffered significant damage after a fire broke out in April of 2019, as people watched on their screens from every corner of the globe. All told, nearly $900 million was raised through donations from 340,000 donors in 150 countries. At the end of November, Macron toured Notre Dame, thanking the restoration workers. Their efforts, which spanned 5 years, cost over $700 million. According to Rebuilding Notre Dame de Paris, the leftover donated money will likely be used to benefit the cathedral in other ways, though the exact plans are unclear. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Britain's Prince William, along with other top leaders, are also in Paris this weekend. President Joe Biden was invited but will not be in attendance due to a scheduling conflict, according to the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre. First Lady Jill Biden will represent the U.S. Ahead of the Notre Dame event, Trump is scheduled to meet with Macron and Prince William, who will also meet with Biden, according to the Associated Press and the British Royal Palace. Macron, Zelensky, and Trump sat down together upon arriving in Paris and posed for photos, though the extent of their plans to meet and discuss the ongoing war in Ukraine is unclear. Earlier this week, a top aide for Zelensky, Andrei Yermak, met with key members of Trump's team on a 2-day trip. The president-elect has vowed to end the war in Ukraine swiftly, yet hasn't clarified how, concerning those in Kiev. After Trump's victory, Macron was the first foreign leader to congratulate him. The French president's recent efforts to be friendly with Trump come after a long, complicated relationship between the two. As the AP reported ahead of Saturday's meeting, Macron was the guest of honor at Trump's first state dinner, and Trump traveled to France several times. But the relationship suffered after Macron criticized Trump for questioning the need for NATO and raising doubts about America's commitment to the Mutual Defense Pact. On the campaign trail, Trump mocked Macron's accent and claimed that his incoming administration would impose steep tariffs on wine and champagne bottles from France if they tried to tax American companies. Heralding the diplomatic relationship between France and the United States is Charles Kushner, the newly named ambassador-to-be. Kushner, the dad of Jared Kushner and stepdad of Ivanka Trump, was pardoned by Trump after he was convicted and imprisoned in 2005, after pleading guilty to 16 federal counts of filing false tax returns, one count of making false statements to the Federal Election Commission, and one count of retaliating against a cooperating witness. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison but was released earlier in 2006. In 2019, Trump, who was president at the time, offered some advice to first responders as the more than 800-year-old structure caught fire. "So horrible to watch the massive fire at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris," he wrote on X, then still known as Twitter. "Perhaps flying water tankers could be used to put it out. Must act quickly." Around 2 hours later, French officials sent out a post that appeared to respond to Trump. "Hundreds of firemen of the Paris Fire Brigade are doing everything they can to bring the terrible Notre Dame fire under control. All means are being used," the official account of the French General Directorate of Civil Security and Crisis Management wrote, "except for water bombing aircrafts, which, if used, could lead to the collapse of the entire structure of the cathedral." Our next headline, how the GOP's trans panic has shades of Putin's anti-LGBTQ plus playbook. This is by Miriam Elder on December 6th. Riot police fanned across Moscow last weekend hunting for gay men. They stormed three clubs, cut the music, and forced patrons to sit on the dance floor as they roamed among them with billy clubs. According to TASS, a state-run news agency, the raids were authorized as measures to combat LGBT propaganda. What a long way Russia has fallen, and how similar the path America seems to be taking. "I was a journalist in Russia when Vladimir Putin launched his campaign against LGBTQ plus people just over a decade ago. Society was broadly homophobic. It wasn't until after the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s that homosexuality was decriminalized. Traditional gender roles were lionized, particularly in the wake of the USSR's collapse, when high unemployment dovetailed with the concerted push to nudge women out of the workforce and into the home. When Putin returned to the presidency in 2012, after 4 years in a shadow role as prime minister, he searched for an ideology to bolster his power. He settled on a reactionary conservatism that centered on anti-LGBTQ+ hate. a bill banning gay propaganda to minors, signed into law in June 2013, paved the way for an increase in social suspicion of those in the gay community. High-profile gay people were fired from their jobs, and vigilante mobs entrapped and beat LGBTQ plus individuals across the country. After Putin annexed Crimea in 2014, sexual minorities were singled out for precision targeting by local leaders in lockstep with the Russian military. "We in Crimea," declared Putin ally Sergei Aksionov, "we do not need such people." The Kremlin's anti-LGBTQ plus campaign has taken many turns over the years, sometimes dark, sometimes absurd. The gay propaganda bill, once ostensibly for minors, was expanded to cover people of all ages. Last year, Russia's Supreme Court declared the global movement for LGBTQ plus rights an extremist organization, even though it is not an organization. Then, lawmakers banned gender reassignment surgery. This year, they set their sights on propaganda promoting a child-free lifestyle and banned that, too. Putin has long been autocratic, but the seeds of his turn to authoritarianism and the brutal war on Ukraine that accompanied it can be seen in that 2013 bill. Announcing his full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, Putin blustered about many rationales, including the West's desire to destroy our traditional values and force on Russia attitudes that are directly leading to degradation and degeneration. He didn't mention LGBTQ plus rights by name, but he didn't have to. How easy it is to look across the ocean and see with clarity the purpose of this campaign. The creation of internal enemies is a key step on the road to authoritarianism and ultimately fascism. Now that Donald Trump and his Republican Party are making similar moves on our shores, some liberals who spent years warning of the threat to democracy are wavering. The moment is too pivotal to bargain with those who would do society's most vulnerable members harm. The American experiment was sorely challenged by Trump's first presidency, from his smashing of norms to the January 6th insurrection. During the 2024 campaign, Democrats put Trump's threat to democracy at the heart of their electoral pitch. Both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden believe he is a fascist and ran their campaigns warning what his return to power would mean for the country. Trump's victory, including his winning margin in the popular vote, however thin, shook the Democratic establishment and sent it scurrying for answers, a process that rightly continues. As the president-elect assembles his cabinet, we see a clear image taking shape, a sea of loyalists who won't question his commands, outsiders looking to bring down the system, and a man accused, at worst, of rape, which he denied, and, at best, a worldview grounded in traditional gender norms and views of reproduction that pose a real threat to the freedom of millions of people. It was jarring, in the days following the loss, that some prominent Democrats and liberals, from Representative Seth Moulton to columnist Maureen Dowd, articulated the case for questioning the rights of trans people. Most zeroed in on the issue of trans girls playing sports and presented their approach as common sense. And yet, it was not so long ago that refusing to obsess over the gender identity of kids who played sports was the common sense view. Back in 2022, when vetoing an all-out ban on trans girls playing public school athletics, Utah's Republican governor noted that the proposed bill upended benefits that were intended to accommodate the very small number of transgender kids in his state, four in total, who were looking to find connection and community. Moreover, of those four kids, only one was playing in girls' sports, he added. That's what all of this is about. Never has so much fear and anger been directed at so few. The Trump campaign reportedly spent nearly 20% of its ad budget, more than $37 million, on TV spots invoking issues involving trans people. That concerted outlay, plus the GOP's campaign against trans people, from bills about sports to bathroom access to healthcare, has all the hallmarks of targeting a small population on which to blame or litigate contentious issues in society. Such efforts against diverse and marginalized communities have effectively mobilized Democrats for decades. And yet, this time, some in the party, first paralyzed in the face of Republican attacks and now reeling from its defeat at the polls, have decided by default to throw the trans community under the bus. This is hardly the only option. Instead, Democrats can and should acknowledge that America is living through a time of enormous change, culturally and politically, medically and technologically, socially and sexually, without compromising their support for human rights and tiptoeing toward aiding Trump in his creation of an internal enemy. In the wake of the election, I called several Russian friends and acquaintances, all involved in various ways in opposing Putin's return to full power in 2012. I wanted to know what we could learn from them. I didn't expect to find the conversation so hopeful. Across the board, these people evinced a faith in U.S. institutions stronger than I've heard in years from those residing in this country. They understand the power of an independent judiciary, of a legislature elected by American citizens, of the idea of checks and balances, so absent in their own nation despite its leaders' hollow insistence that they follow the rule of law. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in United States versus Scrimeti, a challenge to Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for trans minors. This case has implications far beyond the courtroom, wrote Chase Strangorio of the ACLU, who became the first openly trans lawyer to argue before the Supreme Court when he made his case. The lawsuit was brought by three Tennessee adolescents, along with their parents, as well as civil rights groups, including the ACLU. It's being backed by the Biden administration, which is key. After oral arguments on Wednesday, however, it appears the court will likely uphold state bans on gender-affirming care. Republicans have made their intentions clear in targeting trans rights, not least by bending to Representative Nancy Mace, who wasted no time in introducing a bathroom measure in Congress upon the arrival of newly elected Sarah McBride, the first openly trans member of the body. Democrats brushed that stunt off as a distraction, following the lead of McBride herself. But there is much more at play here. In the wake of Trump's shocking win in 2016, most resistance energy flowed to the Democratic Party. This time, the space for dissent feels much more fluid. Democrats are now deciding who they want to be. And allowing the issue of trans rights to tear them apart, as Republicans hope it will be a grave mistake. When Putin launched his anti-LGBTQ+ crusade, his opponents didn't try to figure out if he had a point. They stood up to him in the ways that they could. Many took a brave step of coming out into a society that did not fully understand them. Allies like the legendary journalist Yevgenia Albets began covering the issue prominently and sympathetically. This notion that you have to defend your most vulnerable, that's extremely important. You have to do it, she told me when we spoke last month. Republicans are feeling empowered by Trump's victory. The fact that many Democrats are flirting with some of his basest ideas undermines the very warnings they've spent years telegraphing to the country about his authoritarian nature. Authoritarianism cannot thrive without the creation of internal enemies, be they trans people or migrants. Trump's minions will go after them all. Democrats should not help the cause. Next up, Musk and Ramaswamy warned they're compiling a naughty and nice list. This is by Caitlin Dewey on December 6th. Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy took their government-slashing roadshow to Capitol Hill on Thursday, meeting with lawmakers and brainstorming ideas for tackling so-called federal waste. The two businessmen, tasked by President-elect Donald Trump with finding new ways to radically gut the federal bureaucracy, reportedly told a group of mostly Republican congressmen that they were compiling a naughty and nice list of lawmakers who did and did not embrace their new undertaking. They also listened and took notes as a string of sympathetic lawmakers floated proposals for Musk and Ramaswamy's new Department of Government Efficiency, from scrutinizing the Department of Education to ending remote work for federal employees. We're going to see a lot of change around here in Washington, House Speaker Mike Johnson told ABC, in what may end up being the understatement of the century. DOGE, a non-governmental advisory group, has promised to develop plans to slash as much as $2 trillion from the national budget by firing workers, cutting programs, and rescinding regulations in collaboration with the White House Office of Management and Budget. Some of the duo's early antics have already drawn public scrutiny. On Thursday, shortly before their D.C. session, Ramaswamy told CNN that DOGE would look to claw back on a $6.6 billion loan that the Department of Energy made to the electric vehicle startup Rivian, a competitor to Tesla, which Musk owns. Musk has also used his new perch to antagonize his rivals, including Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman. After Altman congratulated Trump's new AI and crypto czar, David Sacks, on X Thursday morning, Musk butted in with a laughing, crying emoji, which one X user characterized as low-key bullying. As for Bezos, Musk in November posted that the Amazon founder had encouraged acquaintances to sell off SpaceX and Tesla stock, and then emoji laughed when Bezos denied it. Musk stands to benefit hugely from his role in the Trump administration, given the billions of dollars of business his companies do with federal government. That can help explain why the tech billionaire invested a total of nearly $260 billion in Trump's reelection. New financial disclosures released on Thursday show that Musk not only donated $239 million to his controversial pro-Trump Political Action Committee, America PAC, but that he was also the sole supporter of a secretive group that ran ads likening Trump's position on abortion to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's. Those misleading ads enraged Ginsburg's family and served to soften Trump's anti-abortion views. Given these entanglements, a number of good government and civic advocacy groups have called on the Trump transition team to put guardrails around Musk and Ramaswamy's work. In late November, the progressive think tank Public Citizen wrote a letter urging Trump to require that DOGE hold open, recorded meetings and recruit a fairly balanced membership. If the government is going to turn to unelected and politically unaccountable persons to make recommendations as grand as $2 trillion in budget cuts, it must ensure those recommendations come from a balanced and transparent process, not rigged to benefit insiders, the letter read. Thus far, neither DOGE nor the Trump transition team have signaled publicly that such concerns trouble them. It's time for the Best Levin Report. This one was published on December 5th. Lindsey Graham says allegations against Pete Hegseth don't count, one day after calling them very disturbing. Senator Lindsey Graham has declared that allegations against Defense Secretary nominee Pete Hegseth, which include rape, don't count because they're coming from anonymous sources, one day after calling the accusations very disturbing. Speaking to Sean Hannity on Wednesday, Graham declared, "I've known Pete for a long time. I served with him in Afghanistan. The people over there said nothing but great things about him. The allegations against Pete are all anonymous sources. I'm not going to make any decision based on an anonymous source. If you're not willing to raise your hand under oath and make the accusation, it doesn't count. I've heard everything about all these people. None of it counts." As the Daily Beast notes, neither Graham nor Hannity felt the need to acknowledge that the 2017 rape accusation, which Hegseth denies and which did not result in charges, was made by a woman who ultimately signed a non-disclosure agreement after being paid to keep the story quiet, meaning she is likely barred from speaking about the matter. The New York Times revealed last week, too, that during Hegseth's second divorce, his own mother, who is very much not anonymous, told him that he abused women and should get some help and take an honest look at himself. Hegseth's mother told the Times that she sent her son an immediate follow-up email at the time apologizing for what she had written. Elsewhere, the former Fox News host was accused in a whistleblower report obtained by The New Yorker of allegedly being repeatedly intoxicated while acting in his official capacity as president of Concerned Veterans for America, to the point of needing to be carried out of the organization's events. The report also claimed that Hegseth had to be restrained while drunk from joining the dancers on the stage of a Louisiana strip club where he had brought his team, and that while married, he sexually pursued the organization's female staffers. In response to the New Yorker's report, Hegseth's lawyer sent a statement from an advisor to the nominee that read, "We're not going to comment on outlandish claims laundered through the New Yorker by a petty and jealous, disgruntled former associate of Mr. Hegseth's. Get back to us when you try your first attempt at actual journalism." The identity of the whistleblower is often kept anonymous in order to shield them from retribution. Donald Trump and a number of people he's nominated to serve in his second administration have vowed to use the power of the federal government to get back at perceived enemies. Graham's remarks to Hannity would likely come as a surprise to the Graham of one day prior, who told CBS News on Tuesday that some of the reports detailing accusations against Hegseth were very disturbing and going to be difficult to defend against. On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump is considering making Ron DeSantis his defense secretary nominee over Hegseth. Our next headline, Trump brings his Fox hires to 12 with Monica Crowley nomination. This is also published on the 5th. When it comes to the people Donald Trump wants advising him in a second term, the president-elect has a type. Accused of sexual misconduct? You're a shoe-in for a cabinet gig. Did time in prison? Step right up. Related to him by marriage? When can you start? Another obvious plus, and one that apparently far outweighs actual experience, is having worked for Fox News or another Fox Corp subsidiary. While Pete Hegseth is the most prominent network personality to have received a nod, in his case for defense secretary, he's far from the only one Trump has poached from the conservative broadcaster. Others include Sean Duffy for Transportation Secretary and Jeanette Nishawat for Surgeon General, plus multiple additional Fox News contributors. Trump's most recent hire to have worked at the company is Monica Crowley, a conservative political commentator who spent years as a Fox News contributor. The incoming president nominated Crowley to serve as chief of protocol at the State Department, a job that deals in foreign diplomacy and is equivalent in rank to a U.S. ambassador. According to Media Matters, Crowley has pushed several bigoted conspiracy theories about President Barack Obama's heritage, including promoting a documentary about his purported real father. After serving as Treasury Department Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs during the first Trump administration, Crowley returned to punditry, claiming that the deep state has been trying to destroy Trump through COVID-19 and assassination attempts. She was also a contributor to Project 2025. Crowley's nomination brings Trump's Fox hires to one dozen. Of course, he can and likely will add to that number as he continues to fill out the ranks of his new administration. In other Fox News business, Sean Hannity announced this week that Trump will be honored on Thursday with Fox Nation's Patriot of the Year Award, which recognizes America's patriots, including military veterans, first responders, and other inspirational everyday heroes, and is in no way a made-up thing. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for listening. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thank you so much, and have a great week, everybody.